Cecina.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Tennis, the number one tennis podcast with your host, Keith Fraser. Yes, that's me. And my sidekick and former British number one, Mr. John Lloyd. So, welcome to another edition of Rock and Roll Tennis. It's been some time, and I'm with my main man, who's looking exceedingly bronzed. He has been working hard on that tan. What can I say? Here's me on my side of the screen looking pasty. John never fails to remind me, but he has been working hard. Now, here he is. If Marcus didn't know, the nicknames are going to come out. It is, of course, the housewife's heartthrob, the rousing raconteur, the bronzed Adonis, yeah. John Flossie Lloyd. John, you're looking well. How are you doing?
Well, you know, I am working on my tan, Keith, but I'm not sitting out, you know, by the swimming pool. I'm actually on the court. I just played almost 3 hours this morning. We've got a good governor in Florida who allows our to be open and to play tennis and golf and actually go to restaurants. So we're not in the lockdown that I think you guys are, and hopefully you're coming out of it soon. I've had both my vaccines now, so I'm immune. So, you know, I can actually hug a couple of people now without worrying. And life is good, but I will keep working on the tank because I know it is important, and I will do so as much as I can.
Well, it's a great source of conversation for us, John. And listen, we've got another great guest, but we're going to introduce him in a second. I mean, look, we've been a bit lax of late, and you know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. I mean, have you missed me?
Everything's good. I've been playing a lot of tennis and as I say, got that second vaccine, which was important. Last night I had a dinner with someone that Marcus knows. Well, we'll introduce him in a second, but with the great Rod Laver last night. He was he was in town with his girlfriend, and we had dinner with Johan Creek and his wife, and my brother David and his wife. So it was the Rocket Man was great. We were talking about team tennis, and it was just a joy to be around in the presence of such an amazing player, but also more amazing, he's just a fantastic guy, and just he's a treat to be around.
Well, listen, we can talk about that, but I think you missed what I said earlier on, John. I did say to you that we've been a bit AWOL.
And we did. We're back,
and I asked you, and I wanted to know whether you missed me or not.
Oh, I didn't see, I didn't hear that part, Keith. I always miss you. I sorry that you cut out there. I thought you were, and I'm sorry about that. No, of course I miss you. I love our chats.
Yes,
and we have a lot of fun, and we're going to have fun today, and we're going to have fun. We've got some good guests coming in. We've got a very good one today, and we've got some others lined up, and we're back. It's just been a few weeks of. You know, a bit of stuff going on here and there for both of us, and now we're ready again.
Well, you know what they say, John? They say that you never really are grateful for what you have until you haven't got it. So,
correct.
You know, me and you, the people out there, they can now be more grateful for our presence. And that is a positive thing. Listen, let's introduce this guest because he's a very interesting guy. I've had the pleasure of speaking to him on this new platform over the last week's Clubhouse. Great fun, very interesting guy. What can I say? He's a few years back, he was almost the name of Wimbledon because he came through qualifying, I believe, beat Ricardo Berrankis in the first round. And make no mistake, Berrankis was, some years ago, a man that people thought was going to do some damage, you know, in the seniors because I think he was...
Listen, Keith, yeah. Keith Berrankis, who... this gentleman beat, who we're about to introduce, he was good enough that he actually ended my Davis Cup career as captain because he won the match against Dan Evans, and so I don't like him. So I was very happy with my friend that we're about to introduce beat him.
Well, listen, without any further ado, because he is not only your pal, he was also on your team on the San Diego Aviators and World Team Tennis. He's of course Marcus Willis. Marcus, after all that, it's taken a while for us to introduce you. Here you are.
Here I am. What an introduction as well.
It's great to have you. I mean, John has been talking about bringing you on. He talks very highly of you, talks about you, what a great talent you are and have, etc. What have you been up to? I mean, I know recently you sort of hung up the racket. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to at all. I've kind of, it's one of those things where I don't really have a whole lot of choice. I mean, it's what they've done with the ITF system now is made things very, very difficult to A, make money, or B, get enough points to hit the next level. So I came to a point where actually with a young family and with COVID, I've kind of, had to call it a day. I mean, I would have loved to have carried on. I'd love to have found another way, but I was just really scraping the barrel towards the end. And I mean, don't get me wrong, if something changes in the next couple of years, I'm going to keep myself in shape, and I'm hitting balls every day when things open back up. So just for now, I have to get a job. That's the harsh reality of it.
Keith, it's very sad when when you talk to someone like Marcus and you, because I mean, when you're in a sport, you know, an athlete, when he decides or she decides to stop, it I've always thought it has to be the player makes that decision. Not if a person is losing matches or maybe past his or her peak, but when they decide, it's a very personal thing that it's time to end it. But for Marcus, for him to end it when he's still so young because of financial situation is very, very sad. And I when I read about it, because I've been telling Marcus for a while now, I still think I'm a fan of him in singles, but in doubles, I mean, he is a guy that is top 20 material. When he played on our team in team tennis, I've seen him before. And to me, it's the ATP and the authorities, there's something wrong. The finances are not enough where, you know, players like Marcus can't even scrape out a living until they move up the rankings. I mean, it's very sad, really.
It's got worse. I mean, it was never great, but me and Lewis Burton got to sort of 200 in the world within a few months, one sort of 10, 11 tournament. And we're playing Wimby qualities, we're playing challenges, we're in the final of challenges, you're picking up a grand, you know, prize money. But now I played recently, I mean, we played in October, I played with another British guy, we made semis, lost 10-8 in the semis, and we're picking up like 27 euros. And it's kind of like insulting. I'd rather pick up nothing and give it all to the winners. And B, it's costing an all-inclusive. It's like 60 euro a day to stay. So that's fine. You had a bit of private sponsorship, but no one's a big enough mug to throw. I don't know. I think it will cost north of 40-50k a year without a coach.
That's without a coach.
And any money coming back in. You win the tournament, you get $150. Like it's I don't know. You've got to be willing to lose 40-50k. And look, could take me 2-3 years to get where I want at best. Sometimes with the new points, they've halved the points for the winners of these tournaments. So instead of getting 20, you now get 10. So it takes twice as long. Yeah. So it's really like I looked at it and I was like, I'm a pretty positive guy, right? But like, I got to pay my rent. It's one of those situations, and I hope it changes, and I'm gonna be a voice for change if I can. But I'm young. I mean, my body's okay. I picked up a few niggles, but doubles, you know what it's like. It's more about explosive power than endurance, really, in the end, and I've got that in abundance. So I'm going to hang around. I'm still going to keep in shape in case, you know, in case the miracle happens and someone wakes up and changes things. I'll be around. I love hitting balls, as you know, John. So it's the first thing I'm doing when courts open up on the 29th. So,
hopefully I might not be gone. It's interesting because, John, I was listening yesterday to the first ever podcaster we did, and John said to me, you said to me, John, you said, I am the luckiest guy. And you were saying that you didn't take school seriously because you just, you just felt you were going to make it. You just wanted to be a pro tennis player, touring tennis player. But the truth is, it is that hard. I mean, you know, when you consider you can be one of the top 400 best football players in England and be a millionaire, because that's effectively the case. You know, you've got 20 teams in the Premier League and each have a squad of 20-odd players, each on very, very, very good money. I mean, even if you're in the the Championship division, you're making good money. And yet here you are, you're talking about, unless you're in the top 100 in the world, period, you struggle. It's just, I mean, you wouldn't want, you wouldn't really encourage your kid, if he showed promise in tennis, to be a tennis player. Because you'd probably say, well, if you've got that athletic ability, go and play football. Go and play something else, right?
Well, Marcus, I mean, Keith and I have talked about this on the podcast and we've had guests on and various other things. I mean, if you were to do it again as an example, I mean, we've talked about it. I think these days, more so than ever, you know, the best system almost is to go to America and get into college tennis, because then you're playing plenty of, you're hitting plenty of balls against good players. If you do your, you know, the right scouting, you get a good coach, which a lot of these teams have, you get your education. So you're done there. And then you've got a platform to go on. For me these days, particularly with the lack of money at the lower stages, that seems to me like the best bet. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in a small business, two other guys, and we recruit players and encourage them to go to college. I mean, even Arthur Ferry now, cracking player, by the way, probably, top in the UK and actually doing damage internationally as well. He's going to Stanford.
Oh, fantastic school.
And you had Cam Norrie was number 10 in the world junior. He went to college.
Yeah.
Everyone goes to college because, as you say, you get those 4 years. You get, if you're good, you get into a good school, play tons of matches in team environment, not paying anything.
Yeah.
Free degree. And it gives you maturing time as well. I don't think many guys, especially in the UK, are mature at 17 years up.
Right.
And you're asking them to go to Romania and play a Futures alone. Like,
yeah.
You know, without a team around you. So I think it helps people mature as well. You come out at 21, 22 years old. And people take note of college results now. You're going to get opportunities if you do well.
Right.
So you're going to get wild cards into Challies, wild cards into ATPs if you're doing well in college.
Yeah.
So really, what's worst case scenario? You know, you're not playing well and you end up with a degree.
Exactly. Exactly. Like, where's the lose factor?
Yeah, there isn't. I wish I'd gone. I mean, I was one in the UK and 14 in the world. And I got offers like you can't imagine from every uni under the sun. But like, I got roped in by the LTA. I got sucked into all the promises I got given. And a year later, I'm ineligible. And I 18 months later, I'm with Jeremy Bates at Sutton in a huge academy, and we're all traveling to Israel. And you know how it is: no degree, no money. But it wasn't the done thing when I was. There weren't that many players that did it, and the players that did go from the year above me that I knew went and never played tennis again. I didn't want to stop playing tennis. I thought if I went, I'd be sort of quitting.
Mm.
But looking back, I'd have 100% gone, 100%.
Yeah.
Because I love team environment as well. It's just, I don't know many people that don't, actually.
Yeah, I agree.
Great.
Yeah, Keith?
I just wanted to know what you think, because if so many players do slip through the net because of the finances that don't support developing players, I think you wonder how... I'm wondering to myself how much better the tour would be, the quality might even be, if some of the greatest talent were not to slip through the net. Because it's so hard to make it, and if you don't get the financial support and they slip out of the system... You may not be seeing you may have players out there as talented as the likes of Federer and Nadal and Djokovic who just fell by the wayside.
Correct. Yeah. Marcus, I don't know if I told you this. I told you plenty of stories, but I don't. One that may have slipped, not a big one, but you know, about what well, must be 10 years ago now, I suppose, maybe a bit more. I don't know. Jimmy Connors and myself, we got approached by some people, and we tried to get a reality show on TV. And I thought it was going to happen. We went to all the networks and we pitched it. And the premise of that was basically that we were going to get these eight players, eight guys and eight women, and basically have some high-class people train them, and also some people that look quite good, like Anna Kournikova is one of the trainers. And so that you get that, the extra, you know, the kind of the viewing area.
Yeah, what channel is it on?
Yeah, it was going to be quite good. I was quite looking forward to that. But the concept was kind of what Keith just mentioned, was to find players that basically had slipped through the net, had tried to make it on the tour, and financially couldn't sustain it. We're ending up, you know, teaching at a club and other things. And this was a chance for them to sort of come back. And the winning prize would have been money, but also a wild card into a major tennis event. And that was kind of, and we pitched it and we thought it was going to work. In the end, we didn't get it. But I agree exactly what Keith said. There are probably, I can't think of the numbers, but so many players like yourself that are basically, you know, moving out of the game that could still make it and have a lot to offer. And it's very, very sad. I hate to see talent wasted.
Same, mate. It's horrible. I'm not sure the top 10 in singles would look much different, but I'll tell you, from 50 to 100, it could be anything.
Exactly.
I'd say unlikely the end of your Masters would look much different. But, I mean, there's tons of players that I've heard of from the UK, like growing up, that Boggo. Like, fuck, Alex Bogdanovic. Unbelievable, but just, like, how has he gone? How did he not hit top 100?
Yeah,
I mean, and there's others. I mean, there's the David Sherwood. From what I don't know much about him, but I hear all these players that were just done at 24.
Right,
and it's loads from Britain, but probably loads all over the world, because unless you've got a private sponsor, there's no way to really begin. You can't last that long out there financially, and they wonder why all this match fixing is going on, but they're not willing to change the prize money. Yeah. If I'm from Colombia, like, and you know, it's tempting, right? I was lucky all my life to have private sponsors and have a bit of money growing up, and I was sponsored as a junior. But half these guys aren't.
Yeah.
To me, it's not rocket science, and I think some of the tour players, Djokovic included, like, wants to filter the money down. But then, from what I've heard, like, other players are going, no, it belongs at the top. So. If you ask me to give, if I was number five in the world and you asked me to lose money, I don't know how happy I'd be about it, but I think it'd be better for the sport, no?
Yeah. Well, there's got to be a better system that's going on now, that's for sure.
I don't think they should have a choice in how much money they get, the top guys. I think they need to distribute it better.
Yeah.
I think the system has to be, as we've discussed, John. Obviously, you've got the college, but I think that the future of the game in dealing with situations like this is creating a team tennis kind of tour. Because and we've discussed it, Marcus, on Clubhouse, I actually think that if you want to engage fans, then you need to reach down to their emotions, to their fervour, i.e., a bit like you are a Wolves fan, I think, Marcus, you're a Liverpool fan. I think, is that right, Marcus?
Yeah, it's not
correct. I support Arsenal. I get that emotion in supporting the team. Now, of course, if you've got people playing for different teams, they're on the wage bill. They are getting some money for it. Now, I know, obviously, there is a whole financial business plan that is needed, but I think the World Team Tennis, proper World Team Tennis, like we discussed with Carlos Silva, to have like team in England and teams in Europe. There, you are supporting other players who may need some sort of payment structure to develop their game. And then they can use that as a springboard into the individual game. I think because tennis is so individual, you're almost, first of all, they're missing a trick in the promotion of the sport. Because as you always say, John, team tennis is where it's at in terms of the spectacle, but also supporting players who need a platform. You know, if you play for Reading in the juniors and you're coming up, you're on the payroll. That is a massive help to the development of a player. And that's where tennis misses out. And I think it misses out in terms of the showmanship and also the spectacle, because they don't have enough really emotion-evoking team events. They've just messed up Davis Cup. Do you not think the future is with team events?
Yeah, Matt. The worst thing, John, honestly, I'm not just saying this. Like, when I thought I'm going to stop, the year I didn't get drafted for World Team Tennis, and like the thought of not playing that again, that hurt me more than actually going on the tour. I love it, and I think people love it as well, watching it, right?
Yeah.
I think if you watch a best of five set match, certainly second week of a slam, when there's top guy playing, I switch off after 4-1 in the first set. Because it's too predictable. There's not enough energy going on. Someone's clearly better than someone else. Whereas World Team Tennis, every point counts. Every five games, there's six different people on a bench. There's timeouts. There's, mate, yeah. it's like the whole match is an hour and a half, and you get relationships with players, with teams, with you get someone unexpected beating someone amazing. But it happens all the time.
Yeah,
it's just I mean, it's so much fun to play and so much fun to watch.
Yeah, it's great. And Marcus, there's talk. It's not happened yet, and it may not, but I hope it will. But there's a good chance that team tennis may be moving to November, which I think it would be, if it happens, and there's a couple of venues that I can't mention at the moment, but if it happens, it will be a tremendous time of the year, because there's no competition going up against it other than the Masters, the top eight, which are not going to play team tennis anyway.
Yeah, you'll get so many good players.
You'll get so many good players. And if you have a 2 to 3 week season in November, it will be tremendous. And hopefully, if that happens, then become where the tennis calendar thinks of World Team Tennis of November. That's what happens in November, rather than at the moment when it's after Wimbledon. There's so many other tournaments there that it kind of it disappears. It gets sort of caught in the, you know, with all the other stuff going on. But if it's almost got its own spot, when a time of the year when a lot of players, you know, maybe take the time off. But I think if the incentives were right, November could become a very happy ground for World Team Tennis. I hope it happens. But anyway, they're talking about it as we speak.
Because if I'm a touring pro, I'm thinking, I'll go and play that and then have a week off and then do my training block.
Exactly.
And then once you're in the States, you don't need to leave the States.
No.
You can go in Miami, you can go wherever you like. You can train. Then head out to Doha, I think it is, or Dubai the week before Aussie. Is that right?
Correct.
And then you go from there. I think it could be and I think the level, the caliber of players will just, And then you can look at getting more teams. And exactly. I mean, the options are endless.
Yeah. So there you go, Marcus. There's an incentive for you to come back. Marcus is a hell of a team tennis player. I tell you, if there's someone that he gets out there and that gets the crowd fired up and he plays out of his mind on it, he's a really good team tennis player. We have a lot of fun out there as well.
It's good, isn't it?
It's a good event. It's a good event. But Marcus... I was just saying, you know, I just want to kind of change things around now. Just talk about, and I know Keith wants to as well, but about your Federer, your magical few weeks there when you really got sort of put on the map there. I mean, how the heck did it? I mean, how many matches did you play to get to Federer in the first place?
I played pre-qualies, which is just Brits, right? But I played Banbridge, O'Mara, and Salisbury to pre-qualify on the grass. So I mean. All doubles players, but decent enough on grass, right? So I pre-qualified without dropping a set there. Tough. And then I played Sugita first round, who's pretty good on grass. I took Lopez to 5 the year before. Like, I was thinking, crap. And then I played him. I lost the first set 6-1 in about 18 minutes. And I was thinking, oh, golly, let's call the Uber. I got through him. And then I played Rublev, who who hit the hell out of the ball, but was so tactically naive, I can't tell you. I mean, at two games all, I just started bringing him to the net. And like, I mean, the guy was stood on the back fence returning, so I just had a field day with him. I knew it was an amazing win, and I knew on any other surface it would be a lot harder, but I mean, the guy was just screwing. And then I played Medvedev last round.
Are you talking about the two guys at the top of the game today?
Great for the CV, Keith, I tell you that.
Wow. Come on. Rublev and Medvedev, come on, man.
But I was playing really good tennis, and I was discussing this earlier with someone. Like, John knew me as a junior. I was a top junior. I was waterboy in the Davis Cup squad. I learned a lot there. I didn't get given many words. I don't think my personality helped. I said what I thought too much. I didn't get many opportunities, and even though my ranking was there or thereabouts, I feel like, okay, I played well, but I felt like I could do that a few times a year if I was in the right place. It wasn't like I qualified. I was surprised with the result and when it happened, but it wasn't like, oh my goodness, I'm dreaming, I'm playing off my face. I was looking after my serve. I was playing very solid tennis, but it wasn't like I was closing my eyes and swinging. I was just, things were coming together. And I believed I could beat every one of those players I turned up against. I think that's half the thing.
Yeah.
But those 2-3 weeks, I mean, yeah, completely crazy, especially from a media point of view.
Yeah,
you know what the media is like. I mean, one minute they're not bothered, the next they're sort of knocking on your door, climbing your fence at home.
So when you qualified, and you know, you always hear this cliche from players, which I never did, but they only look at the first round draw, and they don't look ahead. Now, you must have looked ahead.
I saw what was going on, but like, I had a lot of media, I had a lot going on. I saw Federer was there. It's not like I didn't believe I could win. But by the time I'd beaten Berankis, I very much believed I could win. By the time I'd beaten him, I'd forgotten about the next round.
Really?
And then I looked up at centre. I was on 17. I came out. It was a swarm. I looked up on centre from court 17. You know the big scoreboard there.
Yeah.
And I saw Federer's two sets up against Pedder. And I thought, oh, f***. Dead's next, you know? But at no point when I was serving for the match or like two sets up against Brankis that I thought, oh, if I win, I play Federer. Like, it completely, probably in a good way, slipped my mind.
Did you go into that match, Marcus?
They're like, you're playing Federer. Sorry, Keith.
Did you go into that match of Federer? Obviously, you were you were riding tremendous confidence high. Did you think that, you know, if you could have clouded, it's like I mentioned, I think, on the other day to somebody, it's like when you go skiing and all of a sudden you realise you're about to enter a black run and your head goes because you know it's a black run. Did you think that you, all of a sudden you're playing Roger Federer and you felt that you were, in a metaphorical skiing sense, felt, oh, well, my God, I'm going on to a black run now?
No, I knew it was a big experience. I believed it, but like a couple of things happened. Like they came and told me an hour before the match, oh, it's not raining yet, but we're going to close the roof because it's forecast. And I was like, oh, do you know what I mean? Fed's indoor, grass,
like
windy out there. I want the sun in his face a bit, you know? But I still went in thinking, okay, I'm good indoors. I'm good on grass. Now I was pissed off. And you know what? When everyone's tapping you on the back after the match, going, oh, well done, mate. You just want to slap around the face. I believed I could win, and I was getting there. I had break points for 5-3 in the third to serve for the third set. I felt like I was with it, slash on top of him. I was getting most of the chances then. And like to lose 6-love on grass, I won like 22 points in the first set. I was just crapping it on big points. Just really, I mean, he makes the court feel small, and you see him in your peripheral vision. You see him sneaking around to that left-hand side. And I think I was just going for silly shots really on big points, but no, I believed I could win. I was for the first 20 minutes. I think John Morris said on the thing the other day, like people coming up to me and he thought I was going to land someone.
but I
was playing great. And my game on grass, lefty against feds, like, and for ages I really wanted to have another go.
But just step back before you, the day before you played Feds, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, these days, you know, let's face it, the high-powered players, the wealthy players, you know, they have an entourage. They have a protective group around them that sort of separates the, you know, the media. You only do certain things and you're really protected. And you go out and do your business on the court, which is great. But someone like yourself, I imagine you didn't have all that protective unit. It must have been like chaos. You must have had your phone running off, asking for tickets and all relatives that you didn't even know existed suddenly are calling you up, you know, to come and watch. I mean, how did you kind of separate that?
You've hit the nail on the head. It's, I mean, the people that came out of the woodwork calling me mate and buddy.
Yeah, of course.
John helped me a lot. So I said to John, like, here's a list. I gave 10 minutes to it.
That's your agent.
Yeah. These are the people I want at the match. Anyone else?
John Morris?
Yeah, yeah. So he helped me a lot. But, like, the media stuff, yeah. I mean, I didn't want to say no to anything. And he had to, like, jump in and go. He had to go jump in and go, no, you're not going on Slovakian TV, Mark.
Slovakia. You could have become a superstar in Slovakia.
But I'm telling you, something like that. And I did 2 hours of media, and it would have been like, had I not been taught, actually, no, this isn't what you do. You're going to have to say no to some things. But I would have been there for like 5 hours.
And you would have been exhausted before you played the match. That's the problem.
But my phone, yeah, it took me till like August to reply to everyone. Wow. Really, I'd see all these messages pop on my WhatsApp, and like, yeah, no, I mean, the close people to me, I reply to straight away. But yeah, you know what it's like. People, just all these people coming out the woodwork. Oh man, great to see you do so well.
Yeah,
I always knew you could do it. I always knew you could do it. Yeah, of course.
Oh yeah. Exactly.
As the old saying goes, there are many people who want to ride in the limo with you, but when the limo breaks down, how many of them want to get on the bus?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a great. I like that one, Keith.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting though talking to you, Marcus, because I sense, and I'm a fairly intuitive guy, that an element of a sadness in you, almost, if you don't mind me saying, whereby you thinking. Oh, if only. Because I get I understand, obviously, and John obviously has talked to you about how talented you are. I've only seen you sporadically, but I kind of sense an element of sadness in you insofar as I wish it would have gone in a slightly different path.
Yeah, and look, some things I did and some things I said were pretty naive when I was a young lad growing up. I mean, it's something I'm gonna have to, might have to live with, you know. It's there is a bit of bitterness in me, there's a bit of anger in me still about everything. But I mean, yeah, what can you do? It's you gotta try and look forward, right? But no, I wish things were slightly different. There are still problems now. I mean, I don't want to harp on about the LTA, but I feel like, you know, that it's not being looked into, and tons of players are slipping through the net because they're throwing all their eggs into one player and putting tons of pressure on a couple of players rather than giving 10, 20 players a lot less.
As we've seen by Asi Karatsev in the last few weeks, who's 27, you know, he's suddenly now 27 in the world, something like that. Just in the matter of a few weeks, at the age of 27, it just goes.
Yeah,
to show
and he's
going to
go
know.
Up. He's going to go up. But this is my plot. Like a lot of players, when they had the bonus scheme and when the LTA, and we had 25 futures and challenges on a year, that's when we had tons of players ranked between 200 and 400 in the world. Now, I'm not saying they would have all gone on to make top 100, but I'm certain a few of them would. The more players you have top 400, the more chance you have of making top 100 players, right? It's just simple math. And then when you hear the next year, oh, by the way, there's 5 tournaments in the UK and the bonus scheme's crap. And you can't argue it. And then now you look at tournaments and it's still the same situation. And the funding, they're giving tons to a couple of players and nothing to others. It baffles me. Mm. Baffles me. Like, they've got to keep people in the game as long as possible. And you know what? if someone gets 200 in the world and gets to play at Wimbledon one day, that's not the end of the world. If they get a wildie in, like Dan Cox was 206 in the world, got a Wimbledon wild card. Whatever happens to him now, he can say he played Wimbledon. And that's not what people should aim for, but it's still a pretty fucking good achievement, if you ask me.
To
most people.
Yeah.
Now, for the LTA, they want as many people to the top 100 as possible. Like, people are talking about creating the next Andy Murray. There's no fucking formula for that.
No.
Those top guys are freaks, right? The top guys in any sport are freaks. There's no formula. You can't drop feed a sponge ball at a kid and then tell them they're going to be Andy Murray.
Yeah.
But you want as many Cam Norries as possible, really.
How far could do you think, if you'd have had the support financially? I mean, John, maybe John should answer this. John, you know,
Financially, one thing, Keith, but actually, like, when you're growing up, sort of support outside of the court, just sort of general advice. Like, they bleed you out to dry whenever you'd make a mistake. Like, there's no support for someone off court. There's no media training. There's no advice. There's no, if someone's sort of supporting you in that sense, and then you're relaxed, you can then go and play your best tennis. I think, yeah, the money's one thing, but there's different ways you can hustle, right? I've found sponsors. I've found ways, but yeah, just support and psychology. I mean, anything.
But what happened after that Federer situation?
Because I
remember when Barry Cowan got two sets off Sampras at Wimbledon, John McEnroe was in the was said to him, right, now you've got to use this as a platform. I don't know what happened after the second round at Wimbledon, coming all that way to the second round at Wimbledon. That, in theory, should have been your platform, right?
Kind of, yeah. I haven't. Yeah, he's all over BT Sport now. I'll tell you that. I don't know about his journey after. But like for me, I had that, and again, there was no. I was by, like, you know, the LTA said to me, "Oh, you can come and hit the NTC if you want." There was no one calling me up going, "Okay, this is your next stage. I believe you could be this good." I mean, Leon Smith spoke to me a bit and said, "Yeah, I'd like to use you in the Davis Cup one day, doubles and blah blah blah." But there was no plan. And again, like, I went off to Kuwait, I won a Futures, didn't drop a set there, knocking on the door challies, and I'd do my elbow. And again, the minute you're injured, mate, like, the minute you're injured, I came back 6 months out, went to hit a few balls at the LTA, and I got an invoice for 24 quid for the court.
No.
I swear. Okay. My ranking had dropped because I hadn't played. I went to practice, yeah. 24 quid.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And you think, oh my god, like, they couldn't stop inviting me after Wimbledon. Oh, come and do an advert for the LTA, we'll pay you, and then you get an invoice. And this is no more than a year later, really. I asked to get an MRI scan. They're like, oh, we can't give you support, but we can give you a half price, $250. Here you go. It's like, they really don't look after you. When you're not in the middle of glory, really.
Yeah.
And that's when you actually need some help a little bit.
Yeah.
Because as you know, John, like, there's periods in your career, right, where you can't fucking win a tennis match. Or like, I made 6 second rounds in a row and it was crap. And that's when my coach at the time started, like, traveling with the player that was doing well. You just like, this isn't what you need, man. I don't know. But it's really obvious to me, and it's really frustrating to have, like, I don't know, lived through that and continue seeing this sort of crap.
Do you know what, Marcus?
And I don't know what it's going to take to change it. I really don't know what it's going to take for someone to go, hold on a minute, what's going on here? You're spending $8 million. How much are they spending on salaries at the LTA, Keith? You know?
Well, I've got to, I don't know, but of course I've got to remain politically correct, because of course John's nephew is the CEO of the LTA, so you know, it's we have to be a bit careful of what we say. But But by the way, everybody has to go at their own association. Yeah. I know for I know that for example, Karatsev, right. when he grew up, he was in Israel till he was 16, and he wasn't considered the one to look out for. Yeah, and he wasn't given the support that he probably wanted. He ended up going to Russia.
Yeah, I mean, look, the LTA helped me a lot, and they do a lot of things right. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to sit here and slag them off and slag Scott off, because I think Scott's one of the good guys in the LTA since he's come in. He's not been there for long though, right?
Couple of years,
right? And things are looking as good as they ever have. Just today, they announced that the winner of under 18 nationals gets a wild card into Wimbledon quali. I think things are moving forward. However, I'm speaking from my experience. When Scott certainly wasn't there doing these things, it really wasn't like that.
I mean, believe me, I've had my battles with the LTA over the years. You know, with some of the things, and it was just not very professional, and you know, they didn't have the right people doing the right jobs and all that stuff, and it was.
Yeah.
You know, there was problem areas. I think it seems to be getting, you know, better. I think Scott seems to be, you know, pushing the right way. It's not easy. It's not easy. That's for sure.
One of the few guys that spoke to me as well. So it's nice to speak to someone who's in charge, you know, as a player. So
yeah.
Things are getting better from what I know. Yeah.
But there's got to be. I mean, you know, British tennis is. I mean, that's obviously, you know, crucial. Obviously, because you're from Britain, but when we start off the conversation, there's got to be a way of this funneling more money at lower events to get more points. But there's got to be a way. How on earth can you move? I was thinking about, you know, when we talked about it, you know, and I, you know, believe that you could be a top 20 doubles player, you know, right now.
Yeah,
but I mean, it would take you conceivably a year because of the points, the way you would have to get it before you could make any kind of, even if you had the money to play them. I mean, you'd have to win bloody every tournament before. How long realistically would that take you to get in the top 100 playing the futures and all that stuff and where you are and no cash whatsoever?
3 years, pretty much. That's with doing a lot of winning. That's 120K down the window.
Yeah, I mean,
that's without an injury. That's without COVID. That's with COVID. That's with loads of tournaments on.
Without having a coach, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Quick question, yeah. John. We talk about the LTA.
Yeah.
And one thing the LTA does do, as the other slams do, is give plenty of wild cards to the home players. Do you think that's fair?
Do I think it's fair? Well, I tell you what, the way I look at it with British wildcards, I believe that opportunities should be given to British wildcards, but someone somewhere has to make the decision on whether they deserve it. I'm not talking about their rankings. I mean, you can be ranked 600, you know, 500, 600, but if you've got the ability and you've got the fire, I think you should have an opportunity. Having said that, I think the days are long gone. They should be where, you know, if someone is ranked 200, you know, a 180, and is, you know, not that far out from getting a wild card, you know, but doesn't put the work in, and there has to be someone that has the balls, if that's the right word, to make decisions on people that have the fire and have the potential. Now, sometimes you're going to get it wrong, and you know, if that happens, then you apologise and give them a wild card the next year. If all of a sudden they, you know, someone got turned down, but then they proved to you that they were the right ones, and you say, okay, hey, you proved me wrong. But I think in the old days there would be a lot of wild cards given out just because they were the top, you know, three or four British players, but they didn't deserve it. You know, they didn't deserve it work-wise.
I agree. I completely agree. I think you need to look at it. It's a grass court tournament, right? Has this guy got a chance of winning as well? Or are we just rewarding him with a 50K wildcard because he's had a good clay court season?
Yeah.
There are some players that, because they put a ranking on it, there are some players who went out to Nigeria and got their ranking. And yeah, it doesn't look good when you're playing good players in the first round of the slam. Tell you that. So you want to avoid that as well.
Yeah.
And with wildcards, like anything, you need to take a couple of risks, right?
Yes.
I think there's this young guy. He's got a bomb. He likes getting to the net. He can cause an upset here. Just give him a chance.
Yeah.
Without worrying about someone getting upset about it who's higher ranked. Like, I think you need to have balls, and I think you need to have common sense.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got to have someone that makes that decision and goes with it. And sometimes you may get it wrong, but you've got to have the confidence in yourself to say, listen, these are the ones, whoever makes this choice, I don't know who it is these days, in terms of actually whether it's Leon or whoever it is, but it has to have the, you know, the balls, whatever, to say, look, this guy may be ranked 30 spots below someone else, but in my opinion, this guy deserves it because of his work ethic and what he's done. And you may get some slack for it, but so what? That's what you're paid for to make the big decisions.
There we go, yeah.
You know.
It makes it interesting as well.
Marcus, you know, I know we talked a little bit the other day about you're getting into coaching. But I would have thought that your experience of what you really needed mentally, physically, and tactically would be ideal for a player who's on the up. So these are tools that you would have, maybe not the tools you would have wanted to have, but tools that you have that you could take forward in nurturing a talent that you think has potential.
Yeah, no, this is what I want to work towards, working with a top player. Of course, I don't want to sit and feed to big groups of women and men who are club players every week. As much as it's good fun and you make good money, no, I want to be working with some top players. It's just the way I need to get licensed, especially in this country, is do my level. But yeah, I think I could offer, I think especially tactically and off the court as well. I think I could help some good players out, and I'll keep my ears open for opportunities. In the same way, I think I've got a lot to learn as well, because I didn't spend a lot of time on the ATP tour, which is where I want to be. So I've got a lot to learn in that sense as well.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What do you think, John? Do you think Marcus's experience on some of the sort of negative sides of the game that he felt he needed could be invaluable when he's coaching an up and coming player or, you know, an established player?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things, great things about Marcus is he's very honest about himself. He's very honest about, you know, his successes and things that he didn't do as well as he should have done and the things he did well. And I think when you're a coach, you have to know and learn from the good parts of what you had if you're as a player and the bad things, and you've got to be able to implement those things in when you're coaching young players. I mean, you know, my main thing whenever I work with players, and you know, as I've told you before, Keith, in many of these podcasts, you know, my great regret in my tennis career is that until the last, you know, a few years when I worked with the late, great Bob Brett, I never really worked at 100% of my capabilities. I was basically a lazy bugger a lot of times. There were periods where I worked hard, but not in general. When you start to see the way these players are at the top level, their work ethic is amazing. I mean, and I believe now, I don't do much coaching now, but what I try and do is I try and tell the players this career goes damn quick, and put everything into it, put 100% into it, and whatever you finish, you'll come out of it and you know you've succeeded. And then the next step, if it's coaching, you'll be able to go in there knowing that you've got something that you can pass on to other players, and you learn from your regrets that you've had and also your successes. And Marcus has had a very quick career, and I still believe he's got a lot more to offer if he ever gets the chance. But you know, he's had good experiences and bad experiences, and if he uses it in the right way, he can become a very good coach because he can throw that out. Doesn't have to be about negativity. It doesn't have to be about what I should have done or whatever, but put it into the right package and help these players that, you know, need nurturing. They need to see what it takes to be a top player.
Yeah.
And that's your, I guess that is your USP, Marcus, insofar as you know, you've been on the hard end of the sport. And that is invaluable to a player who wants to improve and make it. And I think that will serve you going forward in looking for that dream to get back on the circuit, helping others if it's not for yourself.
Yeah, I think certainly with young players and players that want to improve, I think about all the mistakes I made and my inconsistency with my work and stuff like that. I think I can really be an example to help someone else.
Yeah.
In the same way when I was doing things well. You've got to make it constructive and you've got to work out how to get that player firing. I think being good with people as well, and as John said, being honest, I think that will really could serve me well for the future.
Yeah.
Well, we've had Magnus Norman on here, who's obviously been a tremendous player and tremendous coach. We've got the San Diego Aviators head coach, of course, Mr. John Lloyd. And Marcus Willis, hopefully future super coach. You will take over the Morris Oglu mantle or something like that, you know. But look, you know, Marcus, you've been great. I think your honesty is great. I'm a strong believer in honesty is best policy, saying it as you see it, not treading on eggshells. And I think your story is a fascinating one. And look, you're obviously a very talented guy and a great tennis aficionado, player, and I think you're going to be a great asset going forward to the game, whether that be here or to somebody else. You've been great, and I know you've got to go. John, thank you very much for coming on, Marcus, may I say.
Thanks, John. Great to see you, Keith. Good to see you again,
nice John.
Nice to
see you, Marcus.
And great seeing you. If I'm not playing at World Team Tennis, I'll happily be a captain.
yes. You'd be a really good one. I know that.
Marcus Willis there.
Yeah.
John, great guy. And yeah, it's interesting. We've had some great guests. And he's been a fascinating one because he's been at the raw end. And let's make no mistake, you always say it, to make it in tennis, you sometimes have to come through that raw end. And it is a real raw end. For the majority of players out there, that's the harsh reality.
Yeah, it is the harsh reality. And for someone like Marcus, this COVID thing has been obviously, you know, a tragedy for so many, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. It's just awful. So I don't want to trivialize it by talking about, you know, to say, well, tennis, but all sports, every business has suffered from it. For someone like Marcus, for the tennis calendar almost shut down, basically, especially at the lower end. And it just came for someone like Marcus at a really bad, bad time, as it did with many people in all walks of life. But it just sort of stunted the growth that he had just trying to make it come back. And then, you know, as he said, he's basically run out of money. Mm. And it's awful to think that he's such a young guy. And, you know, he's got some magic hands in that game, in his game. And, I could just see him take away the singles, but the doubles, I mean, I saw what he did in team tennis and I've watched him, and, you know, it's very sad to me that he's had to stop at such a young age. But you look at it this way, he's the sort of guy that's going to get on with life. He's got a wonderful wife, his kids are fabulous. So, you know, he's not going to feel sorry for himself. I mean, he's disappointed in some aspects, but he'll move on. And if that is to become, you know, a coach or whatever it is, or an entrepreneur, you know, he'll succeed. I have no doubt about it, because he's got something special about him, as Marcus. I've always loved being around him, and he's a good fella. And I wish him all the best. And I think he's going to succeed whatever he does.
Let's hope so. But, you know, obviously you're a great guy as well, John. It has to be said that a lot of these people who come on, they're your friends have a lot of respect for you. So it's obviously indicative of how much esteem they hold you in as well, John. So, you know, give yourself a big pat on the back for that, you know? Listen, that's it's been great. And I'm great that we can do this again. We've been a bit sort of AWOL, but it's great chatting to you. I get a lot of people saying that they love listening to us. They love listening to you. You've got some great stories and some great knowledge and wisdom, and long may it continue, John.
Well, thanks, Keith. Well, we'll look forward to our next guest that will be coming any day soon.
Please remember to press that subscribe button and share with all your friends. You can also follow us on Twitter, RNR_tennis, and of course on Instagram, rock'n'roll_tennis. And please leave us a review. We'd love to hear your comments. We'll, of course, see you next week, as always. Thanks so much again.